Hey, good afternoon. So we've been talking about caches, and to review, this is our basic set associative cache. We take our address that comes from our processor. So our processor is like the one you're running, you have an input to the instruction memory where you give a PC to load something. And that is not going to go to an actual RAM, most likely. It's most likely going to go to a cache. And this is what that cache lookup is going to look like. So we take the address and we divide it into these pieces. So we have the block offset, the place within the block where our value is stored. So in this case, it happens that this address is stored as this B5 right here, the second byte of the block. And we can tell that because this last bit of the address tells us whether it's the first or second byte. We need one bit because we have two bytes in every block in this case. If we had more, we'd need more bits. We also take part of the address and use it to find which of the sets in the cache we're using. So this cache here has 8 sets, so we need 3 bits to tell which of those 8 sets we want to go to look up the 2 places where we could be storing this address. And when we find the metadata, the tag store information about those 2 places, we want to check, well, is it actually there? Because there could be values here which aren't for this address. Both of them could not be that. So we use this tag. So the tag is part of the address, and that's everything we include elsewhere. So it doesn't include the block offset because we use that. We know where it is, we know where it's in the block based on that bit. We don't need it for the tag. It doesn't include the index because we already know what the index bits are when we get a value out of here, because we know what row, what set of the cache we got it from. But everything else we don't know. We want to make sure that when we read this B5, that we're reading the B5 for this address and not some other address I accessed previously. If it's a different address, we want to tell the processor, no, that wasn't a hit. And we want to move on to the next level of the cache, either to memory or some other larger cache, and do the lookup there. And we need to know whether to do that by detecting whether we have a hit. So any questions about this basic, this associative lookup that we've seen how it works? Yes.
The offset
is 1, yeah, the number 1. So offset 0 is B4, offset 1 is B5. And if we had a larger block, we'd have more bits of offset information. And because we want to use some bits, that also means our blocks are going to be a power of 2 size. Because we want to have some place to look for every single part of those bits. Other questions, comments? Yeah.
So there are 4 lines in every set here, right?
So in this case, there are 2 blocks, that is 2 lines in every set. So we store 4 bytes, but we store them in 2 blocks. So the 00 and 11 were adjacent in memory, and they're stored adjacent in the cache. So we only have 1 tag for both of those 2 bytes. And 1 valid bit for both of those 2 bytes. It's never going to be the case that we read in 00 without reading in 011 here. Yes?
How much overhead does the cache incur? Like, is there a point at which adding more blocks is like counterproductive to actually speeding up?
So the question is, how much overhead does it occur in the sense of if you add more blocks, like make the cache longer?
Yeah, right. So you, for every time you're updating it, you have to pull, like,
So there are diminishing returns with pretty much everything we have here. So if we make pretty much anything bigger, we're going to increase our hit time. We're also going to decrease our miss rate. But the question is going to be, we have that formula. Remember the average memory access time, or the effective access time formula, where we had hit time times hit rate plus miss rate times miss time. And the missed time includes the hit time plus whatever it takes to go to the next level of the cache. And generally, making the cache bigger in any sort of way, like bigger blocks, more sets, sets with more lines or blocks in them, that's going to usually, not always, but usually decrease our miss rate and therefore increase our hit rate, which if the hit time stayed the same, would decrease our effective access time. But the hit time won't stay the same. It's going to get slightly longer. If we added another block to each set here, so we add another column of data and another column of valid and tag, we could do that. That would make this cache bigger, but it would also mean we have more logic here, which would be a little bit slower. It would also mean that this mux here would have 3 inputs instead of 2, which would be a little bit slower. And at some point, that's going to be too slow. And it's obvious that we can't like keep going and make it faster forever, because then we just make memory work that way. And we don't. Other questions? Okay. So it's useful to know how these addresses get split up when we're thinking about caches. If you want to know, well, I know how my program accesses memory, how is that going to work in the cache? So I'd like to start by looking at how our book talks about this. That if we want to figure out how the address is split up into block offset bits and set index bits and tag bits, our book has this bunch of formulas. And you could just memorize these formulas or open up the book when you need them. But that shouldn't be necessary. This is sort of logical things you should be able to derive based on sort of remembering what this picture looks like. So one thing here is that the number of sets is 2 to the number of set index bits. And you can know that because each possible set index bit combination of bits needs to give you a different set. So you know that relationship is that if you have 4 sets, then you need 2 bits to tell which set you're referring to. If you have 8 sets, you need 3, and so on. And similarly, the block size gives you the block offset bits. If you have 8 bytes in each block, you need 3 bits to tell which of those bytes an address is referring to. So you can derive that. You also have this relationship with cache size. So note that when we talk about cache size, we're talking about the size of the data in the cache. Yes, the cache is storing things that aren't data, these tags and valid bits, and other things like least recently used, most recently used, write back information, like is this block dirty or not? So yes, there's that extra information, but when someone says, I have a 32 kilobyte cache, they mean there's 32 kilobytes of data. And some amount of other stuff, but they don't count that. So our cache size is simply the number of blocks times the size of each block, which is one way you can derive this formula. The size of each block is big B, and the number of blocks is the number of sets times how many blocks we have per set. You can also look at this in sort of a way of each column of the cache has so much data. So you can say each column of the cache has S sets times the block size data, and then there's E of them. E is the number of sets per block, which is the number of columns we have of data. Any questions about these formulas and how you would derive them? So something you should be able to do with these formulas is figure out, well, if I have these formulas and I know something about a cache, like I looked up what Intel said my processor's caches were, you should be able to figure out, well, if I have some addresses I'm accessing in my program, how are those going to map to the cache? And this is going to help us understand our program's performance. So start out, I'd like you to do this exercise. So this is the cache parameters of my desktop. So I have a 32 kilobyte cache for the L1 with 8 blocks per set. That's an 8-way cache, and it has 64 byte blocks. Note that this 32 kilobytes is a power of 2 kilobytes, meaning it's really 2 to the 15 bytes, not 32,000, which wouldn't work, it turns out, because you'd try to use all your set index bits and you'd have something left over. That doesn't make sense. And it's the same for these other. So the L2 cache is 256 kilobytes. It's four-way. It has 64-byte blocks. And the L3 is 8 megabytes. Quite big. And it's 16-way and has 64-byte blocks. So exercise that you should do, I would recommend paper, and you can check with your neighbors, is figure out how we take, say, this address and divide it up into a tag, an index, and an offset. So, and a good first step is probably to figure out, first figure out the number of block offset bits and then use this formula, the one for cache size, since you're given the cache size. So who thinks they have part of the answer? One person? Okay. because people need a bit more time? Are people stuck on something? Who don't have part of the answer? Yeah.
Can you show us again how to get the number of sets?
The question is how to get the number of sets. So you're given the cache size and the size of blocks and the blocks per set. So the formulas you can use are, you can use this formula which is the block size to the, which relates the block size to the number of block offset bits. And you have this formula, which relates the cache size to the number of sets, to the number of blocks per set, the number of ways, and the block size. So this is probably the formula that you're going to find the number of sets from.
So yeah. You said 32 kilobytes is how much again?
It's 2 to the 15. This is power of 2 kilobytes.
Okay.
And as you may tell, this is why we did powers of two at the beginning of the semester. That comes up all over the place whenever you do these calculations. Okay, so who's computed the number of sets at least in one of the caches? Okay, so let's start going through this. So my process for doing this is I'm going to first start by calculating the number of block offset bits because that's a gimme from the block size. So I know that the block size is 2 to the power of the number of block offset bits because we need to have one combination of those bits specified each byte of a block. And I can just solve for B, and it's 6. You just take log base 2 of both sides. This is, yes, one of the cases where memorizing powers of 2 will save you time. You can obviously like divide by 2 repeatedly and figure it out, but it's a lot more convenient if you know your powers of 2. And then I'm going to want to try to find the number of sets. And I'm going to use this formula. So I know the number of blocks per set because I was told it. This is typically something a processor manufacturer will tell you. So let's say with 8-way set associative, so it has 8 blocks per set. And I know E, and I also know B because I was told it has 64 byte blocks. So all I'm missing here is S. So I just need to solve this equation for S. So I just do some algebra and get that C over B times E, and if I do that computation, I get 64. So there are 64 sets in this L1 cache, and you can do the same thing for the other levels of the cache, and you'll get different numbers, hopefully. That tells you how many sets there are. And we want to know how many bits from the address do we need to know which of these sets we're going to go to when we look up something in the cache. And that's the same as with the block. We want one set of bits to refer to, each set of bits to refer to a distinct set. So it's going to be 2 to the S number of index bits should be 64. So the number of index bits is 6. So this is the number of block offset bits and the number of set index bits. And many people, because we have these formulas here, really, really want to compute the number of tag bits, which is fine. You can compute the number of tag bits. But you don't actually have to do that to divide up the address. You can just know everything else is part of the tag. That's going to be, and that's usually easier than figuring out number of tag bits. So if you did all this out, you'd find, I think, these numbers, assuming I didn't mess up my calculations. And you figure out how many offset bits, how many set index bits, and how many tag bits there are. Yes?
For the number of sets, I think I did the same thing, but I got 62.5.
So remember, so you got 62.5, so that's not going to happen. It means you did something wrong anytime that happens, or the cache is impossible. And the likely reason is that you were not taking into account that it's 32 kilobytes really means 32 times 2 to the 10 bytes, and not 32 times 10 to the 3, just because you can't actually have that size of cache without doing something very strange. Other questions? Differences of answers? Okay. So this is the first step in figuring out how we take the address that I showed originally and actually split it up. So once we have this information, we need to actually apply it to our address and find the pieces of the address. So what we want to do typically is write our address out in binary. That usually helps. If you're converting hexadecimal to binary, you can take advantage of the fact that each hexadecimal nibble represents 4 bits of binary, and you can just translate it nibble by nibble rather than like taking out a calculator or like converting it to base 10 and then to base 16, which would surely have a mistake happen somewhere. So you can just write it out this way. And then we want to subset the address based on these numbers of bits. And we know that our rule is that the offset bits always come last, because the whole block is contiguous in memory. It has adjacent addresses, and each part of that block has different offset bits. So we know the offset comes at the end of the address. So we have our offset bits at the end. And we know before that, we're going to put our index bits. We could use other bits for the index, but then we would store things that might be next to each other, blocks that might be next to each other in the same set, and that's going to be bad for exploiting spatial locality. We're going to not be able to take as much advantage of spatial locality. So So in order to take advantage of spatial locality, the best choice is to make the set index bits be the ones right next to the block offset bits. So those next 6 bits for the L1 cache are going to be our set index bits. So we can just read off what that value is, and that's the value of the set index for this address. And everything that's left over has to be part of the tag, because when we access the cache and we, with this index, and find the part of the block we care about with this offset, we need everything else. We need to make sure everything else in the address matches, so we know that the value we're getting came from that address originally. So if we're missing any of the other bits, there's going to be another address it could have been, and we won't be able to check that. So any questions about how this is all divided up? Yeah?
So in this case, the tag unit was 1 byte, or I guess the tag portion.
So in this case, it looks like the tag portion is 1 byte, though maybe I'm not showing you the leading zeros in the address.
Yeah, so that was my question. So you can have like a full 64 like bit address.
Yeah.
So like the whole tag could be much longer.
Yes. So if we had a full 64-bit address, the tag will be much, much longer. And in practice, it turns out that part of the reason I'm glossing over the number of tag bits is because this parameter, the memory address bits on my laptop and my desktop, is not actually 64. So it turns out that the way the processor works is that you aren't allowed to use certain bits of memory addresses. If you do that, it's just always an error. This is not what we learn and not what HTLTD does, but that's sort of typically what real processors do if they're 64-bit. They don't bother making all 64 bits work. The rule on Intel is that there's some upper bits of the address which all have to be equal to each other. So you effectively have less bits, and therefore the tag doesn't need to store them. We'll talk more about this when we talk about something called virtual memory, about how many address bits we actually have. But it's going to turn out that we'll have less bits just because, yeah, storing 4 bytes of tags for every 64 bytes seems a lot. It's not too much, but it's a lot. So it turns out we don't actually do that. So other questions? Usually everyone feel like they could do questions like this on the exam, let's say? Yeah, hopefully. Okay, so that's a quick review of how the operation of our set associate caches. And knowing how addresses are split up is helpful for thinking about how is my cache going to perform. We have these shorthands of what the locality is, but if you really want to do it in detail, you want to know, do these things map to the same set? Are they going to conflict or not? And things like, are they going to map to the same block or not? So you want to be able to do this division. It can actually help you in practice to figure out, how can I make my program fast, or why is my program slow? So last time, Samira ended with an example of matrix squaring. So this is a problem where we're accessing a lot of memory, and it depends a lot on how the cache works. And we had these two options with different types of locality. So it's not that either of them had obviously bad locality. There's locality in both of them. In the first example, the accesses to bi times n plus j. So I'll call that bij, and I'll do that throughout today. The accesses to bij have great temporal locality. We do n accesses to bij right in a row. So we have great temporal locality. And we also have pretty good spatial locality in that, because after we access bij n times in a row, we access bij plus 1. And in the second example, the accesses to aik have great temporal locality and very bad spatial locality. And we can say similar things about some of the other variables here. that the accesses to AIK here have bad temporal locality in the first example, but great spatial locality. The accesses to AKJ here have good spatial locality and bad temporal locality. So we have this sort of mix of localities. So there's not actually, so you can say, like, what are the advantages and disadvantages as far as locality goes, which are things the cache is good at exploiting. Spatial locality is going to be good because two things that are spatially local are likely to be in the same block. So accessing them together is likely to be faster. Temporal locality is good because if you access something soon, it's likely to still be in the cache from the last time you accessed it. So those things are good for the cache, but we have a mix of them. So it's not actually clear which of these is better for the cache. And the easiest way to find out, and what people mostly do in practice, is to try it. And now, Samira ended with my performance results. So first, I'll show you important part of this is that these two versions, they run the same number of instructions. And this is what cache optimizations do. It's like, it's not about running less instructions. It's about how long those instructions take. So these two versions, you know, have exactly the same number of instructions. And that makes sense because we just swapped the two fours. It seems like they should do the same amount of work regardless. But the actual number of cycles it takes to run is very different, even though it's the same number of instructions. And you also notice that there's these peaks here. Those are not performance artifacts. Those are not measurement mistakes. Those are real. And often, we'll view this in a different way. So here, I'm giving you the absolute number of cycles and the absolute number of instructions. But the problem is the number of things we have to do is basically n cubed. So this is not actually that easy to figure out. So often we want to normalize. And one common metric when thinking about cache performance is cycles per instruction. Because usually, most of the reason our instructions run slower than the ideal speed is cache misses. So this gives us an idea about how efficient our code is in using memory. Because most of the being less than the ideal number is going to be because of cache misses. So here is the same, you know, basically one number over the other, and we get this chart. And we see more dramatically the difference in performance. And also, it's more obvious that we have these peaks of bad performance. You can also do something that's more problem specific and talk about the number of cycles per operation. And I'm sorry, this does not go down to zero. Which is here, I just took the number of cycles and divided by the number of multiplies or adds I need to do. So this is the amount of cycles per multiply or add, which is the actual work we want to be doing. And that's probably a more useful way to think about this problem, rather than measuring the cycles per instruction, because you don't care if you take twice as many instructions, if each of those instructions runs three times as fast. That's actually good. And you also want something where you can compare what happens at different sizes with the same number, which you can't do with this number of cycles. So another thing we can look at is we can try to look more directly at what's happening. So we see our difference in the number of cycles, and we might wonder, and the number of cycles per instruction. We might wonder, well, how is that actually reflected as far as what the cache is doing? Because we know from how out-of-order processor works that we might be doing other things during a cache miss, even though we don't do that in our pipeline processor you're implementing. Real processors have that capability. So we can also, it turns out, we can measure this. So on modern processors, there are things called performance counters. So you can actually figure out, you can have the processor tell you how many cache misses were there. So I measured that for this program. And you can see that there's much more dramatic anomalies here. And for the two loop orders. So we have, this is the number of read misses to the L1 cache for over the number of instructions times divided by 1,000. So a number of about 9 here means that every every ninth instruction we miss in the L1 cache. Okay, so this chart makes sense, what we're measuring. So this is not the same as performance because we might do some things during a read miss, sometimes we might not. So this is not the only cause of those extra cycles. So let's take a more zoomed in version of this. So I'm going to zoom in on this very first part and only for the bad loop order, the one that's IJK, the one with the big spikes. So here's what's happening there. So first we can clearly see the difference between when the entire A fits in the cache and when it doesn't. So when it fits in the cache, we have essentially no misses. We don't have zero because there's some compulsory misses and things like that. And there's some random happenstance that we have conflicts between things that aren't part of the matrix that are being accessed. And then we start getting misses because things don't fit in. This is that working set concept that Samira talked about, that, you know, that increasing the cache size when we're fitting the working set doesn't help. You know, that's what's happening down here. The working set is smaller than the cache, so it doesn't matter that it's much bigger. We aren't getting any gain from that. And then we have our usual performance and these spikes. And to figure out what these spikes are, which are real, I measured this carefully. These are not something crazy happened on my machine at the time. We can look at what numbers they are. So this one up here, that's 2 to the 7th. It's n equals 2 to the 7th. This one here is at 93. This one's at 114. So what type of cause do these spikes and misses happen? What kind of misses are happening there? Any ideas? So, or first, what do we remember the three kinds of misses that we talked about? What kinds of cache misses are there? The three words starting with C. Yeah. So conflict, is that your
compulsory?
Yeah.
It's neither non-conflict or non-compulsory. Like it doesn't fall to this.
Yeah, what's the other category? Do you remember? Capacity, yes, thank you. So capacity is, so it's conflict, compulsory, and capacity. So which of the, so who thinks that this is a, who thinks that these extra, these spikes are from compulsory misses? Okay, couple hands. Who thinks they're from capacity misses? One or two. Who thinks they're from conflict misses? Who has no idea what they're from? Okay, so why don't you discuss with your neighbor which one you think it is and see if you can come to an actual conclusion. Okay, so now that you had a little time to talk, so who thinks now that it's compulsory misses? Thinks the extras are capacity misses? How about conflict misses? So even less decisive. Okay, so compulsory misses. So their definition of a compulsory miss is that a compulsory miss means that we're trying to access something for the first time, that there's no possible way, no matter how clever the cache was, that it could have it cached. But even if our policy for where we place things in the cache is that address 1234 always gets placed in the cache and everything else gets ignored, you know, we still have the miss on 1234 if it's compulsory. I mean, if that's our cache policy. A capacity miss is a miss conceptually from the cache is just not big enough. And we have good reason to believe that these aren't capacity misses. So one way you can think about that is this 2 to the 7th here, the point at 2 to the 7 plus 1 is way lower. So probably, you know, that doesn't make sense if it's from capacity misses. We'd expect that making the data bigger should not decrease our number of capacity misses, right? Because it doesn't make sense for the cache to perform better with a bigger data set if our problem is that it's not big enough. So we know that these aren't capacity misses. So we're left with our remaining category, which is conflict misses. So who remembers what conflict misses mean? What is a conflict miss? Someone who hasn't spoken? Oh, well, okay.
It's like when you're trying to map the data to like specific spots and like the data ratchets
Yeah, so conflict miss means that we have multiple blocks we want in the cache, but they map to the same set, so we can't keep all of them. And that's something which happens here. And it's related to these being close to powers of 2. So 2 to the 7th is exactly a power of 2. And 93, if you multiply it times 11, is almost a power of 2. And 114, if you multiply it times 9, is almost a power of 2. And this is actually related to what's happening. And to think about this, let's look at how the addresses work. So let's say we're accessing A, K times 114 plus J. And let's say it's at this address. Now, if we access the next element, that's going to be at that address plus 4, assuming we have an array of floats, which are 4 bytes. And if we compute what happens if we access K plus 1, so that's 114 elements later, it has this pattern. And if we keep going and do k plus 9, we get this pattern. And you notice the address looks kind of similar. And that's because we added a power of 2. We added 9 times 114, which is almost a power of 2. That's why it looks similar, because we added something with lots of zeros in binary. And if you remember, we talked about how we divide up these addresses for the cache, and the last 6 bits here are the block offset, and the next 6 bits are the set index. And the set indexes here between this element and this element are exactly the same, even though they're different blocks. So that means that when we're going through our loop through K, we're not using all the sets. Like we access something, and then we access something 9 things later, and it maps to the same set. So we have more things mapping to the same set than we would normally, just because we happen to have something add up to close to a power of 2. So that's the reason for those spikes. And it's also the reason why it's worst for a power of 2. In that case, we map most directly to the same set. We're adding something with lots of zeros in binary every time, so the set is not changing by very much, the set number. And these other cases, the set number is changing a little more, but we still have fewer sets we end up using in the cache. So we get less out of our cache just because of this sort of power of 2 coincidence. So questions on what's happening here? Yeah?
Yeah, can you give an example of compulsory miss?
So compulsory miss is probably most of the misses here. So you know this number is slightly above 1. So the first time we have to read the array, we're going to have to bring it into the cache. That's what the compulsory miss is. So if I start out with my cache completely empty, like I haven't touched anything yet, and I load the data from memory for the first time, that's a compulsory miss. Yeah?
So those huge spikes in performance are when we make those index bits as unique as possible?
So the huge spikes in performance are the question is when we make the index as unique as possible. It's when we have fewer index bit, fewer when you have fewer possibilities for the index bits within some number of iterations of the loop. We're using less of the possible values for the index, basically. So conceptually, one way you can think about it is that we'd like to use this entire cache here, right? All these sets. But we're having much more use of a small number of them. Because many more array elements map to the same small number of sets. So we're not using part of this data just because we aren't generating all the possible index numbers. Okay. So other questions? So I note that I showed you L1. L1 is the most important cache, but we have similar phenomena that happen in the L2 cache. So this is a plot of L2 misses for the two orders, and you see something similar. I've highlighted the version where the array fits in the L2 cache, which is a different size than for the L1, which explains most of it. That's where we go from having almost no capacity misses to having capacity misses. And we also still have the spikes from conflict misses. And there's some other things going on which I'm not going to try to tease out. Okay. So one way of thinking about what's happening in our code, which, you know, where we have these two loop orders and we want to compare what's happening. So let's go back to that and think about trying to tease out how much locality we're getting in the sense of how much that helps us with the cache. And one thing we can look at is let's just start by looking at just temporal locality. And I want to say, let's assume everything was, say, in the same cache block. How much am I getting for each time I load something into a cache block? So I have one cache miss the first time I get a value, the compulsory miss. And maybe I have more. But let's assume that in this inner loop, that every time I do something, that n is big. And that means that, that if I access bij, that it's going to be enough time until I iterate through the outer loop again that I'm not going to keep that stuff in cache. There's enough stuff accessed for if I go through the entire inner loop. So all we care about right now is the innermost loop. Our assumption is that the innermost loop accesses enough stuff that the only reason something's going to be cached is if we kept accessing it over and over again in the inner loop. If we only accessed it once, we accessed it in the first iteration, after the nth iteration, there's enough stuff has happened that's probably not cached. So given that model, we can say that in this inner loop, how much work are we getting out of a cache miss? So each time we access bij, we don't access it again for the entire loop. So basically, we pull bij into cache, access it once, and then we're done with it. We don't use it again until much later when it's probably not in the cache. For AIK, we pull it into the cache once and we access it every iteration of the inner loop. So we use it n times after pulling it into the cache once. So that's really good. So we've done we have one access to the cache to pull it in, and then we use it n times, so we're getting really good use out of our cache for AIK, but not for BIJ. And for AKJ, we have the similar thing where we pull it into the cache once and then we don't access it again in the innermost loop. So if that takes a while, it won't be in cache when we go to the next iteration of this I loop, assuming J goes from 0 to N and N is big. So effectively, if N is really big, we only actually cache one element. So that's not quite what was happening, but that was just because n at being like only 300 wasn't big enough. But when n is really big, this loop effectively caches one element as far as temporal locality goes. Spatial locality is a little better, but I'm just considering temporal locality. So we're going to think about how we can do better than this. And note that this is the good loop order. It's not that this is bad locality. but we've sort of made a compromise. We have excellent locality in AIK. We have good spatial locality in BIJ and AKJ, but we don't have good temporal locality in BIJ or AKJ. So we're going to look to try to get better locality in the other things. And as a compromise, our locality in AIK isn't going to be quite as amazing. But that's going to be OK. And one way of thinking about how efficient this is that we're accessing a little chunk of AIK, a little chunk of AKJ, and a little chunk of BIJ. This is what the inner operation does. And when we're iterating over J, we have this stripe that we're accessing for those other things, and one thing we're accessing over and over again for AIK. And so during that J loop, we have this cache block that contains AIK that we're pulling in the whole thing and using one little piece of it. That sure seems like a shame. And maybe if N is not too big, we could cache this whole AKJ here, because we use it again in the next iteration of the I loop. So if N is not too big, we might have that cached. But if N is too big, we won't. Assuming that, we'll have it cached if all these cache blocks I have in blue fit in. I have it wrapping over because the cache blocks aren't going to be precisely aligned with our matrix. It's just how it's going to work. And B, we won't reuse this block until the outermost loop, until we increment K. So it's unlikely, unless we can keep all of A in cache, that this cache block's going to ever be used for anything else. So this makes sense, the sort of cache usage we're getting out of our example. It was sort of shown in two ways. So another way of looking at this is I can sort of think about this program as if I'm explicitly managing the cache. So Samira mentioned that, you know, some things like GPUs have programmers explicitly manage the cache, and we don't do that on processors. But when you want to think about, you know, the performance of your program, it's good to think as if you're explicitly managing the cache. So what we say is, you know, you imagine I'm choosing to put AIK in the cache here. That's how you should think about it. You don't actually write an instruction to do that, but because you're accessing it over and over again, you're going to cause the processor to do that. And you imagine you loaded BIJ and AKJ once, and then get rid of it. You don't explicitly do that, but because you access it once and then don't use it again, that's what's going to happen with the cache. It's going to be loaded in the cache and then discarded, assuming the automatic management, you know, works like we expect and takes advantage of locality. So there's going to be a transformation I'm going to do, where I'm going to, you know, change this to have better locality. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to change nothing. I'm going to have exactly the same access pattern. I'm just going to make our loops more complicated. And what I've done here is I've split the loop over k into two loops. So we set kk to 0, 2, 4, 6, 8. So we can have k go from 0 to 1, then 2 to 3, then 3 to 4, and so on. So this is exactly the same computation in exactly the same order right now. So this makes sense to everyone? Everyone see what I did here? Questions? Confusion? Okay. So I've just split up the loop. So I've made this program slower because I've made the loop more complicated. But I did this because there's something I'm going to do that takes advantage of that. So remember, our first thing we did to improve our performance, to change how the locality worked, was reordering the loops. So now I've split up this loop. I'm going to reorder the loops by taking the loop over the inner loop over k, the one that goes only two elements, and putting it in the innermost spot. So now I've actually changed the order in which we access memory. So this is going to change what our locality looks like. So let's try to analyze what locality this has. So to do that, I'm going to expand the loop. Okay. So I just took this loop here, this loop over k, which goes two elements, and just wrote out both of the iterations. So So I just substituted in KK and KK plus 1 for K and put both iterations. And we can look at the locality we have. So previously, we were accessing Bij and never using it again. Now, we're accessing Bij twice. So we have better locality in Bij. Previously, we were accessing Aik and never accessing anything else from that cache block. Now we're accessing Aik and Aik plus 1. So we have more spatial locality. And, you know, and we've made some compromises to do this. So for AKJ, we have less spatial locality now. We have less locality in general. But it's still not too bad. And for AIK, we have a little less temporal locality. We're not accessing AIK over and over again. We're accessing AIK and something else. But the temporal locality is still pretty good. And the spatial locality in AKJ and AK plus 1J is still pretty good. It's not as good as it was, but it's still pretty good. And in exchange for that, we got a whole bunch of extra locality. So this makes sense, why I have an advantage here? Questions? So given that, if I look at, say, how this affects cache misses, this actually improves the number of cache misses. And yes, I'm not showing you actual performance, and you should be suspicious of that. But it improves the number of cache misses. And basically halves them, because we have all that extra spatial and temporal locality. And that was just because, in exchange for getting rid of a little bit of the most good possible locality, we got a lot of extra locality, which means that when we process a block of stuff, we're doing a lot more work. When we bring in stuff into the cache, we're doing more computations on each item. Previously, we bring in Bij and use it once. Now we use it twice. Previously, we bring in the block containing Aik, and we only use one part of it. Now we use two parts of it. And so on. Yes?
So what exactly the measure for locality? It's just how many times for temporal locality, is how many times do you keep on using a value? And then spatial is how many times do you use a value from the same block over and over?
Yeah, so the question is, how do we measure temporal and spatial locality? So temporal locality is most straightforward. It's if I access a value, how long is it until I access that value again? If we have good temporal locality, that number is low. For spatial locality, it's a little more subtle. The basic idea is, if I access a value, how likely is it that I'm going to access a value that is close to it soon? And we don't have quite a really precise measure. When people try to think about cache performance in practice, typically what they do is measure or simulate. So they'll simulate a cache with a certain parameters and see what happens, right? Because they actually care about things beyond locality, like when exactly conflicts happen.
So it's more trial and error to figure out optimal locality.
Yeah, question is it more like trial and error to figure out the optimal locality? So for optimal locality, you can reason about it, because it is sort of a how close are things. But for optimal performance, that's very usually better locality is better performance. But because of things like conflict misses, it's not quite so straightforward. So in practice, people do something which has good locality and figure out the details, like what exact numbers to use, things like that, with actual measurement. So for example here, I used 2. I could have used 3. And in practice, that's the decision that's going to be made by measuring. You can try to reason about which has more locality, but in practice, it's better to say, well, this is going to have good locality, and I'm going to measure exactly which number works best. So I did this by splitting up the loop of K and moving the two pieces. So why did we just do that in K? Well, that was an arbitrary choice, and I could have done it in anything, and I can do it again. So let's say, for example, I do the same thing I did to K for I. So I can split up the loop in I, and now in here, I have four calculations instead of two. And if we expand this, I've found yet more locality. So previously, we accessed AKJ in the innermost loop, and we never used it again. We had temporal, we had spatial locality in AKJs, but no temporal locality. If I do this expansion of I, now I found temporal locality in the AKJs. You know, so I have more calculations for that one time I load the cache block containing AKJ, and also for the cache block containing AK plus 1J. So I've gotten more efficiency out of the time I'm spending loading stuff into the cache, the time I'm waiting for cache misses. So this makes sense, so how we can just pile this on. And so if you want to go to this other view here, we're taking a block of AIK. So we have AIK, AIK plus 1, AI plus 1K, AI plus 1, K plus 1. So a little square, a 2x2 square of AIK, and a little strip of AKJ and BIJ that we process in the innermost loop. And we, just as before, we iterate through J going across the matrices. And we have more efficiency than we did before. So for each AIK, like we started out, we're doing n calculations after loading the value once, assuming that n is big again. So when we finish up our loop, anything we weren't using over and over again isn't in cache anymore because we're accessing enough stuff. But now we're doing two calculations for each other thing in B and A that we're accessing, whereas previously we were doing one or two. So you've sort of gotten twice the efficiency out of that part of our cache usage. And I mentioned earlier that 2 was kind of an arbitrary number, and we could have chosen a different one. So why don't we choose an infinitely large number? Why don't we choose like a very big number? What's the problem with that? So why wouldn't I go up to, you know, instead of plus 1, why don't I go up to like plus 1,000? So, other people who haven't answered the question today? So if I go up to plus 1,000, I'm going to have like bi plus, so I'm going to have like bi plus 0j equals ak plus 0, then bi plus 1j equals ak plus 0, then bi plus 2j equals ak plus 0 1,000 times, but I'm also going to have equals ak plus 1, ak plus 2, ak plus 3, ak plus 4, up to 1,000. So what's going to be the problem with that? Yeah?
I think you're getting more locality for the bij's, but then you're effectively losing the locality for another term. So it just kind of goes back to the first thing.
Yeah. So if we make this size too big, if I do too much in I, I have less locality in these AKJs because I'm going to have more stuff in between. So there's some trade-off here where we're losing locality in the AKJs, and that means as far as the cache is concerned, it's more likely the stuff we have in between will cause us to remove AKJ from the cache. So with a size of 2, that's not going to happen because, you know, a 2x2 block of stuff is like 16 bytes and our cache is 32K. But if we choose sizes of like 1,000 or 10,000, we're going to be in trouble. But we will generalize this. And so the general pattern is we skip over some amount in K, I, and J. And conceptually what's happening is that in this triple inner loop, where we're processing a block, that we're going to have, we're going to have a block of A, two blocks of A, and a block of B that we want to stay in cache. We're going to access all the elements of all parts of these blocks repeatedly in that innermost loop, and we want these to be small enough that all of these things will end up in the cache and stay in the cache. So we access BIJ once. We want it to be the case every other time we access it, it's in the cache. We access some part of AIK once. Every other time we access it, it should still be in the cache. So we need to make these blocks small enough that that's going to happen, but big enough that we when we access BIJ, we get to use it with all this other stuff as much as we can. So that's our trade-off. So, and we want to make the numbers as big as possible because, you know, this BIJ here is used big K times, whatever the amount of block we have in the K, for the K variable. So if we make K bigger, we'll get more locality in BIJ, but if we make it too big, we'll end up having these AIKs running out of room in our cache. We'll try to store all of them for all the big K possible Ks, and we'll run out of space. So we want to choose something that basically, you know, uses as much of the cache as possible. So we have to have, we want to cache this much stuff. So a way that we can sort of guess what a good size is we want to choose some number for big I and big K and big J such that this fits in our cache. There's some other considerations because conflicts matter, for example. But that's sort of the basic intuition, is that I'm going to choose the size of this these blocks so that this fits in our cache and uses most of it. So we get the maximum advantage, because as long as we aren't adding cache misses, bigger blocks are better, because we get more use out of each of these things that we need to load into the cache to run these inner loop. Questions about this? So generally, as I said before, what you should do, when figuring out how to make your code good for the memory system, good for caches, is you should think about choosing what's in the cache. And that's what we're doing here. We're saying, in this innermost loop, I know what I want to be in the cache. I'm going to pretend I can choose what's in the cache. And we're going to plan, when we're doing that, to use as much of the cache as possible, basically. And that's sort of where we're going to start out. Now, we can't actually, on our processor, say, yes, definitely get this in cache. There, as Samira mentioned, there are things like GPUs where that actually happens, where there are instructions which say, bring this value into cache. But that's not how our processors work. But by reusing values repeatedly without using other values in between that will make them go away from the cache, we effectively choose what's in the cache. And this ends up actually helping our performance. So, you know. So I need to choose sort of how much I'm going to fill most of my cache, so I need to choose I, J, and K. So an example of a way to do that is I can say, okay, if I set them to 48, that's about 27 kilobytes. My L1 cache is 32 kilobytes, so that's a reasonable number. I could do the same thing for the L2 cache. And that's sort of how I get my rule of thumb. This makes assumptions like about conflict misses and replacement policies. So in practice, people generally start with something like this and try varying the number and seeing what works. But this is a good starting place, and it's usually close to the right number. For if you choose to do this calculation for also the other caches, because sometimes the L1 cache isn't the one which affects your performance the most. And even if you don't match correctly, we saw that plus equals two helped. So it's not that you need to get this precisely right, but this will give you the most advantage. So you might say, well, does this actually help our miss rate? And it does, by a lot. Note that we still have a bit of a problem with conflict misses, perhaps more of a problem with conflict misses. But overall, our miss rate is a lot better. And this means that our program is going to, for as long as we're sort of above this point here, it's going to be faster. It's going to be slower below that point, it turns out. But it's going to be faster above that point. So we get this sort of performance, which seems bad. So I have two versions here. I have a less optimized and a more optimized version. So as long as our loop is efficient, we get greater performance. if our loop is not efficient, so in this case I had more instructions running in the loop. I'll talk about that after the exam. But the extra cache performance didn't matter because my loop was less efficient. I was doing more bookkeeping of the I, J, and K's, and that makes sense because we have more of that, and it ended up mattering. So here I've simplified that bookkeeping, and this is the performance I get. So it's slightly faster. It's not much faster, but where cache blocking is really beneficial is when you have very big sizes. So I don't have every single point here because if you think about how big an 8,000 by 8,000 array and you're doing a 8,000 cubed operations on it, that takes a while. But when you get to really big sizes, it starts helping. In particular, this red region is the size of my L3 cache, that 8 megabyte cache. So when it stops fitting in the L3, we see it helps by a lot. And that's what I have for today. So some logistical notes. So there is an exam next week, as you probably know. So Tuesday will be a review. If you want questions answered during it, you should come with questions. If you don't have questions, it will be a very short review. Also, yes, there is something due on Wednesday before the exam, and we are aware of that. And there are pipelining questions on the exam, so we suggest, knowing how your pipeline processor works, that you have to do in that assignment.